Welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is sizing and analyzing JVM memory usage under Kix Transaction Server for ZOS. Today's presenter is Mike Poyle. Mike is a Kix Level 3 Service Engineer in Ursley Park, UK. Mike started work with IBM in 2006 as a Java ZOS Level 3 Service Engineer and has handled many Java memory usage PMRs. He has continued to look at this type of problem during his time in Kix service. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Mike.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, can we skip to slide number 3? There's quite a lot to handle today. I'd like to get into the detail as quickly as possible. Okay, the background of this presentation is that over the years I've handled a number of PMRs, and what I've tried to do this time compared to the previous presentations is to look at what the customer can do to figure out how much memory a JVM is using. I've assumed that none of you are using Java 1.4.2, and you're at least on Java 5. And if any of you would like to see more detailed information, I can supply presentations. Slide 4, please. The first part is to look at what Java is available with what Kix. For Kix 3.2 and 4.1, we're talking about 31-bit Java with JVMs running a single application program. The difference really is in the level of Java that's in use. Slide 5. When we move on to Kix 4.2, we're now into full 64-bit mode operation, either using JVMs in a JVM pool, or more importantly for now and the future, one or more JVM servers. The JVM server technology enables you to run multiple thread-safe application programs per JVM. And the strategy here is to remove as much of Kix as possible from the interaction with Java itself. You'll see that at the bottom of the slide that when you go to 5.1, it's a different release of Java, but specifically the JVM pools are no longer supported. So 4.2 is a migration release, which enables you to prepare for the Java environment in 5.1. Slide 6. As always in issues like this, make sure that you are at a good Kix and Java service level to avoid problems that are inherent in the code. Slide 7. Okay, these are the sort of questions that I often get asked by people. The first one is, how do I estimate the size of a JVM? And the answer to that is quite simple. You can't. It's not something that you can use a formula to calculate. It is an issue for 31-bit JVMs because of the limitations on the ZOS address space. Anyway, you can't estimate the size of a JVM. Page 8. The obvious follow-up question to that is why? And it's because the JVM is so dynamic in what it does, that there isn't a formula that you can use. It uses a lot of what it calls native memory, and by that it means private storage in the address space. This is a byproduct of the design of the JVM and what the Java code is actually doing. So the JVM needs storage or memory for control blocks and actually data areas as well. And it is a function of not just the JVM itself, but also what the Java application is actually doing. Now, a JVM runs a number of threads, which you'll see as TCBs. And there is at least one thread for the Java application that you're running, maybe another one if it creates additional threads, but there are also JVM server threads as well. Each of these are going to be using code that is within the JVM, and as we'll see later, this is C and or C++ code, and it's basically a series of functions that are invoked, and every level of function that is used requires read-write memory for save area and for data areas. So we've got control blocks and data areas, and we've also got stack storage that is used, and it's very much a variable amount. Now, as if that isn't complex enough, we also have to factor in memory that's used by ZOS itself, language environment, and Unix system services, because the Java is a Unix application. So it's a very complex mix of requirements that have to be factored into the size of the JVM. Slide 9, please. Okay, right, now you told me you can't. What can I do? Well, effectively, all you can do is measure the sizes of the JVMs and then figure out how many of them are fit. Now, the first part that we're dealing with, specifically 31-bit, because this is where most of the problems are. However, if you're going to measure it, I would suggest that before you do that, you check your configurations and make sure that there's nothing that is known to be bad in there, because there's no point in measuring a system that's not configured to best practice. And the last point on slide 9 is, from practical experience, if you do a sizing operation in test, you can't afford to assume that it will be using the same amount of memory in your production environment, because there may be some differences. So make sure that you measure both in a test and a production environment. Slide 10. Having measured the amount of memory used by JVM, the next question is, does it really use that much? Is that how it should be? Well, chances are, yes, it could be that is how much it does actually require. Before you, well, when you open, when and if you open a PMR against KIX, one thing that's helpful from our point of view for you to bear in mind is that 99% of the time, the problem isn't actually anything to do with KIX at all. It's the way that the JVM is designed to actually run. But that's not to say there aren't some configuration options. And our response normally in level 3 is to have a look at information that's supplied and figure out if we can optimize the usage in some way. So although it's not our fault, we do try hard to make it work better in your environment. Slide 11. The main problems that I've encountered, particularly recently, is that there are settings in the JVM profile that cause much more memory usage than should be the case. And the parameters that we see are Java command line options like minus X OSS, minus X no class GC. And essentially, if these parameters have amounts of megabytes, it's highly likely that you're using much more memory than you should need. And in one particular case, just by removing minus X OS 4 megabytes, we were able to change a 200 megabyte memory requirement to 46 megabytes. So to give you an idea, before the change, you could probably get 5 JVMs in the KIX region. And after that, potentially, you could get 4 times as many, which can make a big difference. Now, not all cases are like that. This is an exceptional case, but it illustrates the point, and that a small change can make a big difference. The main thing that you need to do as customers is, when you get a new release of KIX, cross-check your JVM profiles that you're using against the ones supplied by KIX, and if there are any differences, make sure that you understand whether it is valid or not to carry those forward. Many of these problems that we had in this area were due to old JVM profiles being copied into the new release and no longer being necessary. I-12. Okay, so how do you approach the business of measuring a JVM? Now, I've introduced DFH0 stat as a way to measure it. It's not going to be the only way, but DFH0 stat is a vanilla way of getting the information that any customer can use. As I said, it's not the only way, but it's just a common standard. Now, what I've done to illustrate it is based on a very simple test case from my environment that is based on a Hello World Java application running with a JVM maximum heap size of 16 megabytes minus XMX. The minus XMS value that you use for Java has no influence over the amount of memory that's allocated for the JVM heap. The JVM heap is always allocated according to minus XMX, and minus XMS is just a line that's drawn within the JVM to decide when it needs to go through garbage collection. So let's have a look at what you can actually see based on my Mickey Mouse application. Well, DFH0 stat tells us that we've got about a gigabyte of memory available in the private area once Kix has started up. At this point in time, no JVMs. The second part is after I've started a single JVM, and you'll see that you suddenly lost about a third of a gigabyte. 190 megabytes has gone into LSQA storage, and 140 megabytes has gone into region. So the first JVM that starts can take quite a big hit out of your region. Slide 13. Starting the second JVM, the difference is only about 72 megabytes. So that's not so bad. So there's an initial hit, and then every JVM after that tends to be a similar-ish increment. Now, DFH0STAT can actually tell you how much memory a JVM is using. Before you run it, you have to select the dispatcher NVSTCB triple because the default is no. And if you look at the printout, you'll look for TCB names with J8 or J9, and it will show you how much memory is being used below and above the lines. You can see that's at approximately our 72 megabyte figure. So you can tell how much each JVM is using, but you've seen from those two slides that there is also another amount of storage that isn't so easy to explain. Slide 14. Oh, here's some good news. I deliberately set up my JVM profile with a bad minus XOSS value, and having taken the parameter completely away, or reset it to what Kix suggested that it should be, the JVM has now reduced in size from 72 to 36 megabytes. Now, all the difference there is stack memory. That's memory for the threads that are executing. The JVM had minus XMX 16 megabytes, so you can see that the overhead of the JVM side of things, apart from XMX, is 20 meg. Now, that's not going to be the same for every JVM, obviously, but starting off from 16 megabytes, we have got quite a lot of extra storage for the JVM itself. Slide 15. Okay, this is summarizing DFH0STAT. What can you get out of DFH0STAT that's useful? Well, it's good at showing you the memory that's consumed as a whole, and by individual JVMs. But what it can't tell you is if there's anything that you can do about it. Okay, so it's useful if you know that it's completely useful if you know you've done all the tuning that you can do. Slide 16. Okay, so we know that there's a memory hit from running JVMs, so where does it all go to? Well, I can explain most of it fairly easily. Now, we've seen that there's a one-time hit, and that comes from two main sources. One is from Unix System Services, the shared lib region size. Now, the shared lib region size primarily covers DLLs used by the C code. The memory itself is mapped in the USS address space, and as soon as you use one of those DLLs, that memory is mapped back into your KIX region in LSQA storage. So you've only got to touch one DLL and you get the whole lot. The shared lib region size is a system-wide value. Okay, there's some other LSQM memory that I can't easily explain. And when you're using JVMs, you're normally using the JVM shared class cache. And again, as soon as you activate the JVM, you'll be loading one class cache, which should be shared amongst all JVMs in the JVM pool. You shouldn't have more than one of those, although I did have a PMR when there were several, which I think was solved by changing the Java SR level. Okay, so that's in private storage, not LSQA. And as it says at the bottom of the slide, you do get something like this for 64-bit JVMs. So 64-bit JVMs doesn't mean automatically that a complete loss of a 31-bit memory usage. Slide 17. Okay, so now we know that there are two major components to the one-off memory. How do you find out what they are? Well, if you issue DO MVS, L, you'll get told about the share lib region size and some other parameters which have an effect one way or another on the shared class cache. I have to apologize here because I noticed when I was preparing that I'd actually copied in some values here from another document which didn't match my system. And the system that I used for the previous example, the share lib region size was actually 144 megabyte, not 293, and the maximum usage was 123 megabytes. Share lib region size is a system-wide value, and basically, if there's a big difference between the high water usage and the system limit, it may be possible to reduce that, and then you can reclaim the difference in every region that uses Unix system services. I've known some installations to do that, and others to say, sorry, no, we can't do that. But the potential in this case is to reclaim a huge amount of memory for your KIX region. Slide 18. What about a shared class cache? Well, the most accurate way to find out about the shared class cache usage is to run a Java command in a TSO region. The Java command is given you on this slide, and it's the xshare class's printstats with the name of the shared class cache. The shared class cache is kix underscore shared cc underscore the applet of your kix region, and it's normally version 0. And in this case, it tells us that the cache is 40 megabytes in size with about 38 megabytes free. So potentially, we have up to 38 meg in this extreme case that we can reclaim should we change the shared class cache size. Now, it's not normally that ratio, but it gives you, it enables you to see if there's some more memory that you can reclaim. Remember, like shared libregion size, this is just one. It's not a multiplied saving, it's a single saving. If you want to change the size of the shared class cache, then you have to destroy the old one and then either do a cold start or an initial start of your Kix region specifying a different JVMCC size. It must be a cold or initial start. Otherwise, you'll end up with a default of about 16 meg, which may be too small. Anyway, so there's some potential saving there. Slide 19. DFH0stat can also give you information about the class cache size if you select the appropriate option. I have had some issues with this in the past. Recent tests of later releases seem to show that it's more accurate than it used to be. As I said, the most accurate way is to run the Java command. In this case, we've got exactly the same size as reported by the Java command. Slide 20. Okay, so we looked at the one-time hit memory usage. What about the JVM? Well, the amount of memory used by the JVM is, as I said, it's a dynamic amount apart from minus XMX. So the memory allocated for per JVM comes from the minus XMX value. Now, this is what's known as LE heap storage, and the amount is actually XMX plus a little bit. It also uses LE heap memory for the JVM control blocks and data areas, for example, JIT buffers, RAM class, which is the internal memory representation of the executing state of your Java classes. That's for Java 5. Java 1.4.2 didn't have that. You also have LE anyheap memory, and that's for LE control blocks and what's known as user thread stack. So that's stack storage for threads that operate in a particular mode. And lastly, you have what's known as LE stack storage, and that's for, again, for threads, and it's the for functions that work in XP link mode, which is most of the functions in the JVM code itself. Slide 21. Okay, so where the heck has LE come from? How does it fit in to the picture? Well, as I said earlier, when you have a look at the JVM code itself, it's mostly a combination of C and C++ code, or at least it was last time I looked at it, which was over 4 years ago. And in order to run C code, you need to involve LE, which manages the runtime side of it. LE has runtime options that you set up to tell it how it should manage the memory. Now, C code will be issuing functions like malloc, and it might decide to malloc 8 bytes of memory for holding something or other. Now, if LE translated a malloc into a get main, then there would be a horrific CPU overhead for handling C. So what it does is you tell LE for particular types of memory that you want it to allocate in segments of an initial size, maybe 4 meg, and then an increment of at least 1 megabyte. So the first request comes in, whatever the size, and LE is going to allocate, say 4 megabytes. It will then begin to sub-allocate and free the allocations in there. When a request comes in for memory and LE can't fit it into that initial segment, then it will allocate an increment or secondary, and so on and so on. So LE takes the approach that get main free main is too much, so what we do is we'll compromise and have our own memory management policy to avoid some of the CPU overhead. Slide 22. It's a bit of a compromise though, and the runtime options that you have in place for that JVM will determine how efficiently LE memory management works. And one of the problems that you typically face is that you have one set which is shared across a whole number of different JVMs and their applications. So they have different memory usage profiles. If you want to find out what options are in place for your JVMs, you can enable LE heap stats in the JVM profile, or you can recompile your LE runtimes and put report ops on, and report storage on is for actually showing the way that LE uses their memory. Okay, so runtime options are important, and this is an area where I've had to make some suggest some changes to help things work more efficiently. Slide 23. Okay, what are the options that have an impact? Well, any heap is an option that doesn't normally have a significant effect on memory usage, but it's useful as a start to explain how the parameters work. As it says, this covers the LE control blocks, which are required for LE itself, and the user thread stack, sometimes called the up stack. LE will initially allocate 4K, and when that runs out, it will allocate a minimum of 8K. But if LE or whatever asks for a megabyte, the increment would be actually a megabyte in size. Any means that it can be allocated anywhere within the 31-bit address space, but preferably above the line. And 3 says when an increment becomes completely empty, then LE free mains it back to ZOS. Those are kind of reasonable values, but how do you know they're reasonable? Well, we'll see a bit later. Slide 24. The statistics that come out of LE, here we've got one for my Mickey Mouse Hello World application, and you can see the initial and increment size is reported there. The total amount of what's known as element storage is reported there, and that's about 1.5 meg. There were this many get requests and this many free requests and a number of segments allocated and freed are shown as well. Now, 1.5 meg is not a lot of memory in the context of a JVM. And it's not normally an option that is useful from a tuning point of view. You won't save a lot of memory on that. The only problem from this is we can see the logical amount of memory used, but we can't see how that is actually mapped from a segment point of view, which is the memory that's taken out of the address space. But we can see, we can get an approximate value of how much memory, but it is not completely accurate. How we get it accurately? A bit later. Slide 25. The heap runtime option is one of the important ones. And the parameters work in a similar way if we ignore the last two. Basically, the initial segment size is 4 meg, which is often too small for a JVM, and the increment is a minimum of 1 meg, which is again too small. This is important because it's used for the JVM heap and many of the Java control blocks and data areas, so it's potentially quite a significant option. Slide 26. Now, where the LE memory management starts to get inefficient, it is, as I said before, it's a bit of a compromise, segments and then elements. The LE uses a first fit algorithm. So if you say to LE malloc 1K, LE starts at the most recently allocated segment and checks to see if there's 1K contiguous free in there. And if there isn't, it moves to the previous one, and if there isn't, it moves to the previous one, and it goes all the way back to the initial segment. And if it still can't fit 1K, then it's going to allocate an increment, a new increment segment. Now, meanwhile, the application is probably issuing C-free function calls and freeing memory potentially anywhere in the stack of segments. But LE, when it doesn't allocate, always starts at the most recently allocated one. So it tends to overload the most recently allocated segments and leave holes in the earlier ones. So there's always an amount of fragmentation with this memory management technique. If your JVM works in a particular way that doesn't fit in terribly well with the LE heap settings, you can end up with a lot of segments and a lot of fragmentations. And this has been reported in at least in several PMRs as a suspected memory leak. And we've cured it by going back and changing runtime options. So whatever you do with the heap option, you're always going to get a degree of fragmentation. It's just how much fragmentation can you sustain. Slide 27. Okay, so tuning this is something that I've done a number of times. So what do I aim for? Well, trying to map the whole of the requirement as one initial allocation sounds like a good idea. But the problem is that you could be sharing this across multiple JVMs that run different applications and have different memory requirements. And I have seen one PMR where there was a guess on how much this should be, and that ended up wasting memory because too much was always allocated. So what I try and aim for is a reasonably sized initial segment and a small number of increments. So how do you figure out what that's going to be? Well, slide 28. The statistics we get out of LE for heap is similar to any heap. We can see how much memory that we used, number of requests, number of segments allocated and freed. That tells us that we used about 124 meg of element memory. The number of segments allocated is slightly higher than I would prefer to see, but not horrendous. In one particular case, I've seen thousands of segments allocated, and that suggests severely severe fragmentation. What it can't tell you, though, is how much native memory has actually been used, because you can't see how many segments and their sizes, because you can't guarantee that the increment is always 1 meg. It could be 50 meg. And you can't see fragmentation. All you can get from this is that it looks reasonable or unreasonable. Certainly the total heap requirement of 124 meg doesn't fit very well with the 4 meg initial size. Yeah, that could probably possibly do with maybe reducing to perhaps 100 meg initial, so increasing to 100 meg initial, and then maybe 4 meg secondary. But again, we're guessing as to whether this is bad or not. Slide 29. Heap pools. The main thing to know about this option is to have it set off unless we advise you to set it on. You can do a lot of damage with this one. Seen it. It can help, but used in the wrong way, it can actually increase memory usage and make things worse than before. So don't use that one unless you're told to. Slide 30. Stack. That controls the thread stack sizes. The first two parameters are the user or upstack, and the last two sizes are for the down or XP link stack. In both cases, the sizes are reasonable for KIX. Slide 31. Okay, now, JVM profile parameters like -XOS modify the initial XP link size, and that's where you can have problems. So instead of 32K, you can be given 4 meg, and there could be 20 threads running. So you've got suddenly got 80 meg of stack memory when you probably need about 1 meg of that. So it is possible to override these, and the JVM itself actually overrides the initial stack on some of the threads that it runs and actually uses a smaller value. So what you see here is not necessarily what you get for the XP link stack, which is the 128K initial parameter 5. Slide 32. Thread stack is a variation of stack, and it basically tells LE what to do for the second or subsequent threads. It's normally worth setting that off and let it default to the stack. Slide 33. Okay, statistics from stack. This is the user or upstack. Stack statistics is the first thread, and the largest used is about 12K out of 32K initial, so that's okay. What you don't want is a largest used that is more than an initial size. Thread stack. These are the subsequent threads. So we know that this JVM had 10 threads running, only one of which was your Java application. So as I was saying, a JVM is more than just your Java application. In both cases, the difference in sizes is reasonable. And remember, this comes out of any heap, which includes LE control box as well, which is 1.5 meg. So there's no point in adjusting that one. It's not going to save you much. Slide 34. XP link. Okay, what have we got here? 128K initial size, and largest used by the first thread is about 36K. A little bit of saving. And the second and subsequent threads, nine of which there were, is only about a K. So there's a little bit of saving here, should you wish to try and play, but you have to understand that what LE is reporting is not necessarily what is actually happening, because some of those sizes can be changed dynamically when the thread is initialized. It's a parameter of thread initialization. So although we can see that maybe it's not quite optimum, we can't again here see the total usage. Slide 35. You can modify the runtime options by assembling and linking a new JVM RO, remembering that the parameters that are passed into it, and it's like heap pools, whatever, can't be more than 256 bytes. That's nothing to do with KIX, it's LE. So the statistics can show you possibly that there's some options there for making things a bit more efficient, and you need to recompile something to make it work. Slide 36. Okay, so summarizing what I covered about LE, LE runtimes can be important. And if you ask about LE statistics, you can look at them and see whether there's some room for maneuver to reduce memory usage. But again, but early statistics can't tell you the actual native usage that's been made because of its policy of allocating segments, and segments can be different sizes. So from that, for that, only DFH 0 stat is usable, and even then it only gives you a total. So you've got DFH 0 stat that's telling you this is what it used, but can't tell you if you can optimize it, and LE suggesting that possibly you could optimize it, but doesn't tell you exactly what's being used for what. So you're getting a couple of, well, not getting a huge amount of help. Slide 37. So, why does IBM ask for dumps? Well, we know that dumps help us to get the detail that we really need. We use, well, this is me. When I say we, I mean I use IPCS Verbex VSM data, and I can look at the output from that, and I can identify the shared lib-region size, shared class cache, and any heap segments in subpool 1. Nobody else normally uses subpool storage apart from LE. Slide 38. In subpool 2, that you can see LE heap increments and XP link segments, and the XP link segments always slightly bigger than the size that you specify or are inherited. You can see the memory usage per JVM, because it's easy to identify them, and at this end it's relatively easy to match the VSM data reported allocations to the type of LE memory. So we can actually see the native memory usage, and within reason identify it against a particular type of allocation. Slide 39. Here's a little bit of VSM data. Towards the end of the VSM data report, you'll see local subpool usage summary, and you can spot the JVM TCBs because they're using subpools 1 and 2, either with key 8 and key 9, and they have a lot of memory associated with them, so that they're fairly easy to spot. Now you've got the TCB address, slide 40. If you find using the TCB address, then you can see the detailed native memory allocations. Subpool 1, here we see a size that's slightly over 4 megabytes, and that's the heap initial. You can see the heap initial, which was 4 megabytes, turns out to be something slightly bigger, and it hasn't used quite all that memory because we've got FE8 bytes free. Okay, so subpool 1 uses about 5 meg. If we look at subpool 2, we can see a number of allocations for 402,000. That's a giveaway to me because that's -OSS4M. I've seen enough of those used to recognize those. It's 4 meg plus the 8K extra from XP Link. The 1 meg is heap increments, and we've got an 8 meg buffer, which I know normally to be JIT, and I can see the minus XNX 16 meg, which is 16 meg and a bit. Now, there are quite a few lines that have been removed from this, so it can fit on the slide, and if you look at the subpool 2 total, Charlie 2 megabytes in size. And I'm trying to remember how much that actually is. That's 16 times 12, 160. It's about 190 meg in total with subpool 2. So if you want to try and make some savings, the savings you want to make are in subpool 2. And I've already spotted that we've got minus XOSS 4M use. So we've got 39 of them. There's potential to save a lot of memory in this case. Slide 41. Now, that's something that you can do. Something that you can't easily do as a customer is to look at the second thing, which is the Verbex LE data. Now, we've got some Rex code that we can run called BossHeap. And that takes the Ellie Data report, which is absolutely massive, and consolidates it into a much smaller number of lines, and we can actually look at that to check the segment sizes, the fragmentation, and common usage by element size as well, which can sometimes be useful. So from our point of view, we have a slight advantage. It's nothing that you can't do, but you'd have to write Rex code to parse the data and do what we do. Slide 42. So from our point of view, we need dumps because it enables us to put the whole thing together. As a customer, you can see where there are some bad settings, and you can look at the LE statistics data and guess that something doesn't look quite right. But LE data is quite useful. Slide 43. Again, PMRs, we've had PMRs for native memory leaks. What we typically do, we'll ask for a series of dumps spaced over time, because a memory leak may not be a memory leak as such. It may be just bad for runtime options. And we can look at the LE data and things like that and either eliminate that or not. If we can't explain it, then it could be a Java memory leak, in which case Java service are likely to ask you to add the heat check parameter in your JVMRO and run that to show where the memory is being leaked. JVM heat leaks are completely separate, and it's nothing to do with this whatsoever, and that's kind of you on your own there. Slide 44. Okay, just to wrap up a little bit about 64-bit JVMs. As most of the memory is above the bar, providing you've got a suitable mem limit, it's not the amount of memory being used is not something that you typically worry about too much. The problem with 64-bit memory is that it's quite difficult to find out exactly what is being used by what, because it's all done by memory objects, and you've got memory objects with hidden bits, and it's a total nightmare to look at it even from a dump point of view. DFH0STAT will give you some information about storage above 2 gigabytes, and that can tell you that Kix is allocating 2 gigabytes. There's another half a gigabyte in use for something else, but you can't really figure out what it's used for. Slide 45. DFH0STAT still tells you about 31-bit memory usage, and this is the JVM that I used before, but it's now in Kix 4.2. And we're now using about 1.5 meg compared to 72 meg or 36 meg before. So a 64-bit JVM will still use an amount of 31-bit memory. And when I looked at this, I found about 1 meg was associated with JIT. If you get the VSM data, you can actually have a look at the memory, and you can see eye catches and things like JIT-W in there. That was a giveaway. Another half megabyte was something to do with LE. Okay, so 64-bit JVMs doesn't mean that you don't need some 31-bit, but it should be significantly less than what there was before. Slide 46. What else can you see? Well, in the TCB's report, you'll see some non-Kix TCBs for JVM server. And one of those will have a small amount of memory. So it's about 4.5 meg of memory was required to run this particular JVM server. And that was due to heat pools being active. As it says there, remember this is only one JVM versus many that you would normally have in a JVM pool. So JVM server, like JVM pool, still needs an amount of 31-bit memory. And it says there were multiple non-kick threads with 56K negligible amount. Slide 47. The LE64 4-bit runtime options. DFH JVM RO is JVM pool, and DFH AXRO for the JVM server, which uses larger heap segment sizes because you expect a much bigger JVM heap. 64-bit stack is now in 1 megabyte increments, so you will be using more than you used before. And of course, 64-bit means 8-byte pointers and things like that. So a JVM is going to grow in size. You've got heap 64 parameters. Megabyte multiples there. Possibly not the best. Slide 48. Heap pools and heap pool 64 are both active for JVM server. That should be reasonably sensible because of the because of multiple JVMs running and possibly making better usage of the memory. Stack and thread stack as before, but slightly different parameters. So we're talking about megabyte multiples now. Sorry, I think I got stack 64 confused with heap. Sorry, stack 64 is 1 meg, a minimum of 1 meg in size, increment of 1 meg. So you're going to use more stack memory, as I said before. Slide 49. Okay, just to summarize the whole thing, JVMs can use a lot of memory. And remember that this is probably nothing to do with KIX itself, although it could be a function of options that are available in KIX provided files, but possibly not the ones provided by KIX. You can't estimate the amount of memory that a JVM requires. You can only effectively measure it, and you can do that using DFH0 stat and dumps. If you're having problems with 31-bit memory, it doesn't mean that there's necessarily nothing you can do. You may be able to reduce the memory usage by changing some of the configuration parameters, but you might need some help when you get to the stage of looking at how efficiently LE is working from a segment point of view. But you can use the LE statistics options to tweak the statistics output, to tweak the runtime options and see if you can save the memory. Okay, well, I guess I'm at the end of what I was having to talk about, so I'm handing over things to Dave.
Okay, thank you, Mike, for a great presentation. Before we get to the question and answer session, we would like to conduct a short poll. 4 questions will appear in the web conference, and your responses are greatly appreciated. The first question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes what you think about this statement. The information presented today was useful to me. Strongly agree, agree, neutral, disagree, or strongly disagree. I will pause a few seconds here to collect your responses. Thank you. And the second question, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes what you think about this statement. The material was well organized and clearly presented. And the third question, did this call meet your training expectations, yes or no? And the last question, we'd like to know, how did you hear about today's WSTE webcast? Thank you for participating in the poll. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject WSTE Subscribe. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better. We welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. Moving on to the Q&A session, I would like to remind you that for those of you who join us via the web conference, you can also post your questions in the group chat. Precedence will be given to questions asked through the phone, and if time permits, we will also address questions in the group chat. At this time, Daniela, we would like to open the lines for questions. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Mike, for presenting today.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.